Welcome to The Crossing, the sermon podcast from Washington National Cathedral. We're so glad you're with us, and we hope this week's episode gives you comfort and inspiration. Be sure to check out our other Crossing podcast, Tower Talks, where you can find untold stories from cathedral docents, volunteers, staff, and artists who have each helped make the cathedral into the national treasure we all love. And now, enjoy this week's sermon.
I think I need to start here. Peace be with you. Let's have a seat. I needed your peace in case you're wondering why I started there. It's a little out of order with the service. Let me start by thanking everyone for coming today and lining up around the church, and thank you to this amazing cathedral for inviting me here to be with you. If you judged what an honor it is by how much I'm shaking, it's a big honor. But I have to say that I just have to keep remembering this is church just like at home, but not exactly like at home, but it's church, which for me in many ways is home. As I started preparing for this sermon, I was reflecting a lot about my own faith story, my own faith journey, which has been adventurous, we'll say. When I think about my relationship with God, I would describe it as an amazing love story. And I think if we were hanging out with another couple, they might say, wow, they still have that spark. Like, after all these years, there's still passion and commitment. And I think that's true. My relationship with church is a different story. It's been a lot rockier and a lot more difficult. I think if you were a couple who hung out with us, you'd probably say, look, be together, break up, whatever, just choose. You're making us crazy and it's not good for the kids. Pick one. And I was thinking about that a lot. I'm like, maybe I need to go to couples therapy with church. Like, yeah, I'm a social worker. That's what we do, right? And I think if we went to couples therapy, me and church, I think the therapist would say, what's wrong? And I'm like, church drives me crazy. I just can't do it anymore. I'm done. Be very specific, Brene. Well, here's the thing. We have to talk about social justice issues or it's not church. We need to talk about race and sexism and homophobia and heterosexism and Islam. All the isms and phobias need to be on the table and addressed. But don't get too political from the pulpit. Then I would say, look, I need the people at church to be confident, certain, and sure about God. But don't be pious. I want them to be, you know, I'm vulnerable and messy and hard all week long. I want to go somewhere where everything's kind of buttoned up and exact. But don't be like that either, because I don't trust that in church. And you need to watch your language in church, which I know is some irony coming from me. If I had a dollar for every Facebook post that I got, I posted a picture of the cathedral last night and said, I'm going to be here. And if I had a dollar for everyone who said, watch your language tomorrow, zip it up. But the church really needs to watch its language. Seriously. I want some more exacting translations of these words. Like, there are words I just don't agree with, so I've come to make up my own. I'll give you an example. My husband, Steve, and I call ourselves Borg Again Christians because we left church until we found Marcus Borg. And then Marcus Borg brought us back to church. And it was so funny reading his book, like meeting Jesus for the first time, because I'd be like, yeah, this is good, but I'm not going back to church because there's the whole Nicene Creed thing. And then you turn the page and he's like, let's talk about the Nicene Creed. I was like, wow, it's like magic. But here's an example. Like, he argues that when we say we believe in one God, that the real translation of the word believe is beloved. Like, I can be down with that. I beloved one God. And if you beloved your God, right on. This is, I believe in my one God, but because I beloved that God. So I'd like him to get clearer with the language, and I'd like them to let me less concerned with my language. And I think that therapist would look at me and say, but what do you love about church? Is there anything you love about church? And that's when I would completely light up. That's when I would shine so bright and say, oh, just there are things at church you cannot get anywhere else. There are things I love and crave, and when I'm not going, I miss it and I'm worse off for it. And then I'd get really specific, because there are three things that I just love about church. And they're not the things I think you're supposed to love about church, which here makes you nervous to talk about. But I love church for three reasons. One, I want to sing with strangers. And wow. Let me clarify. I want to sing with y'all and strangers. I want to pass the peace with people who 6 days a week I might like to punch in the face. I do. I want to go to church with people that I don't vote like, believe like, agree with, but on that day, I want to look at them and send them a prayer of God's blessing. I want to look at them and shake their hand and look in their eye and say, the Lord's peace to you. And I want to receive that back. And then I want to share the rail and break bread in communion with people I don't know. That's why I go to church. So I'm just thinking, looking at the bishop, if we could change the order of things so we could sing, shake, eat, go. That I get from my dad, who I was baptized in the Episcopal church, but then became a Catholic. I became a Catholic in Catholic school. Like, I actually literally got called into a room one day, and I walked in. I thought it was God, but it was a bishop, and we read the Nicene Creed, and he asked me questions about it, and then I took home a mimeographed letter that said, Brené's Catholic now. And so, you know, it was like, you know, 1970, and so my parents were like, God made Brené Catholic, so they became Catholic. And so growing up at Catholic Mass, our instruction was, and it was there were six of us, and it was a serious instruction, which I'll edit down, which was, get the wafer and do not stop till you're at the car. Get the wafer straight out the back. You know how the Catholics park. Get the wafer into the car. I'm like, but there's a song at the end that, we'll sing in the station wagon, get in the car. And that is literally, so I still have a little bit of that in me. So when I was thinking about these things I love about church, I thought, this doesn't make sense to me at all. Until I started doing the research on belonging. And here's what I found. I found that over the last 20 years, and especially the last couple for us, we have sorted ourselves by ideology into bunkers. We have literally sorted ourselves into factions. We now live with, worship with, go to school with, hang out with people who believe like us. And we have very little interest in people who don't believe like us. And you would think the upside to sorting, you think that, you know, the great part of that is we'd be behind these barricades of ideology with our best friends ever. Except, as we have sorted, loneliness rates have tracked equally with sorting. So the more sorted we become, the lonelier we are. Which begs an incredible research question, which is, why is that happening? And I think it's happening for a simple reason. I think behind the barricades of belief is not real connection. I think we just hate the same people. And I don't think hating the same people is how we connect with each other. I call it common enemy intimacy. I don't know you, particularly like you. I'm not interested in knowing you, but I'm glad you hate those people too. And loneliness, it's a serious, real thing. In fact, in the UK, they just wrote about a study that they have been doing over the last 5 years, where loneliness is an all-time high, and the parliament has just last week appointed a minister for loneliness because it is a health epidemic. And you think, you're lonely, it's not going to kill you. Wrong. Loneliness is a greater predictor of early death than smoking, than obesity, excessive drinking. Loneliness absolutely kills you. And we're lonely. We're lonely. So when I ask, what do men and women, what's happening to us? And I would define where we are right now in this highly polarized world as a crisis of spiritual connection. It is a crisis of spiritual connection. And I don't mean a crisis of religious proportion, because religion plays a role on both sides of conflict and heartache, honestly. But it is a spiritual crisis. And the definition I use of spirituality in my work, and it crosses every religion, is the deeply held belief that we are inextricably connected to each other by something greater than us, and something that is rooted in love and compassion. I call that God. Some people call it fishing. People call it different things. But I call that God. And here's the thing about the inextricable connection between me and you and the Syrian refugee and the mother in the Congo. It cannot be severed, but it can be forgotten. And we have forgotten that we are inextricably connected to each other. We have completely severed our memory around that. And so when I ask the question, what do men and women do who are able, even in the midst of the chaos that we're in politically right now, men and women who maintain that belief in inextricable connection, what do they have in common? One of the answers was hold hands with strangers. Find moments of collective joy and pain and be a part of them. Pass the peace with people you want a frog in the arm. Come to the rail. Sing. Grieve together in community. And we don't do enough of that. And it's not just around church. It's about music, sometimes sport. Find ways to be with people in communion that you don't know as a reminder that connection between all of us is real and alive, whether we forget it or not. Then I ask myself, what is the opposite of that? Is it isolating? And it's far worse. It is the scariest thing I've come across in 20 years as a researcher. And that is the opposite of collective joy and collective pain is dehumanization. And we are in a time of rampant dehumanization. And dehumanization is an interesting thing, and it's a slippery thing. You know, it's interesting when you think about neurobiology. We are neurobiologically wired to take care of each other as a social species. We're not wired to kill and maim and torture and rape and hurt and belittle and shame people. It actually goes against our wiring. So when we feel extreme hatred, or more likely fear, we engage in a process of dehumanization. We take a group's humanity and start moving it outside of what we see as human. And what is the first, because if we move it out, if you move a group of people outside of what you see as human, you have permission to do anything you want to them. But what is the very first part, what's the very first stage of every act of global dehumanization? Language and words. Every genocide in history started with a dehumanization campaign of a group of people. Followed, and that started with words. So here would be my call to you, my call to action from the sermon today. If you're offended when you look on your Facebook page, and you see someone calling Hillary Clinton or Maxine Waters the B word or the C word, you should be equally offended if you see someone calling Ivanka Trump or Ann Coulter those words. If it takes your breath away and makes you want to cry when you see people attack the Obama's Barack and Michelle's daughters, you should feel the same way when people do that to the Trump kids. And that's hard, right? That's hard. But it's not a question of what side of politics you're on. It's a question of what side of humanity are we on. Because if we continue down this path, we will get to the place where we don't see humanity in each other, much less connection, and we will be able to do anything we want to other people, and we're close. And if, like me, you're a person of faith, you're a member of this Anglican Communion or any faith, you are called to find the face of God in every single person you meet. And there is really nothing more unholy than stripping the humanity away from a person through language or any other endeavor. It's funny because those moments of collective joy that we're experiencing here, I mean, how many of you had goosebumps, really, show of hands, when the music started and the procession started? And then how many of you at the same time were like, okay, this is too fancy? Right. All of them included, let me just tell you. I have to confess, the bishop, and that's high ranking for those of y'all not in the community, leaned over to me and said, you know, we're just people, right? This is fancy for us too. And I was like, yeah. But those moments, but there was a moment of collective joy singing together, right? How many of you are not Episcopalians? How many of you are here for the first time for an Episcopal service? Yeah, we're so glad you're here. And that's what I want this church to be, because there's name calling and words that are dehumanizing, but there's also things we do that we need to do better. How we treat people of other faiths from our church can be dehumanizing. Where's the big sign that says, be you, be here, belong? Our debates about the LGBTQ community, they should be done. They should be done. They should be here. You know, what God has brought together, let no bigot pull apart. You know, just, we're done. This is about love. And I am grateful to be with you today. I am grateful to pass the peace with you today. I'm grateful to sing and lift my voice with you today. And I'm grateful to come to the rail with you today. So, amen.